listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we take a look at the situation in Venezuela with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua.
The fundamental reality is the United States has lost Eurasia, to put it in those crude terms, because it simply can't compete militarily, economically, diplomatically even with Russia and China in the Eurasian lands. And when Trump came to power, he took the decision to drop out of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which opened the door for Japan, for example, to play a more important role. And perhaps in some ways, Japan was a proxy for the United States in that sense. But what has actually happened is that there seems to be a strong recognition of the East Asia, Southeast Asia, Northeast Asia's self-interest. You know, you've got South Korea trying to reach a stable agreement and end the war that was never the war. They never signed a peace with North Korea, right?
Right.
So you've got South Korea trying to do that. You've got Japan trying to stabilize its position vis-a-vis China and its neighbors, and that's just an example in another part of the world of the way the United States has lost its power and influence. And although it still has its military power, and that to some extent has been cut down to size, if you like, by the fact that that Russia has new armaments that render, for example, United States carrier forces irrelevant in terms of geopolitical menace, because they just get wiped out if any conflict ever started. But that has been the basis of US power projection for as long as anybody can remember, hasn't it?
Yeah, you know, and so, what's interesting about this, by the way, I mean, you mentioned Korea and that. You know, Korea, the southern part of Korea has essentially been occupied since 1910, since the Japan-Korea Treaty, right. You know, with Japan occupying it. And we know the history of Japanese occupation of Korea, right. You know, with, you know, murders and rapes and all the horrors of all of that. And then the U.S., this part's not widely known here, but what happened in essence, when the U.S. Got its unconditional surrender from Japan, it essentially took over the bases of occupation in Korea from Japanese. And they essentially became the officer class for the occupying army, and then replaced the people on the ground. And so, and then the same guy who did that was Truman, started the war against, you know, to try to recapture the entire peninsula. And there has been no peace treaty since then. And then and so you have Japanese and China's and Korea's interests all, you know, being really reoriented to the reality of things there. I think that's just the sheer force of reality pushing, you know, driving events there, and as well as the people of both, you know, parts of Korea. But the U.S. is doing the same thing also. I mean, to me, Venezuela is a lot like Libya was to Africa up until 2011. It was a focal point and a financer of unity, of a development of of a process of integration, sort of a guarantor of independence. The huge role that Libya played in the African Union, for example, in fact, from changing it from the Organization of African States OAU, I think it was, to the African Union, and the conceptual changes that with a goal, an avowed goal of African integration, pointing towards its own currency. I mean, these are all the kinds of things that Venezuela was talking about at UNASUR only 2 years, three, 4 years ago. And they blew Libya into oblivion. And now it's, Venezuela's turn, I think.
And so, the reason for us, when we're trying to focus on Latin America, to talk about what's happening in Asia, and as you pointed out, in Africa too, is that the United States has taken the decision that it's going to defend its hemisphere. It's going, and because it can't project its power, its military power, and now even its economic power effectively in the areas where it used to. And so what it's trying to do is to lock down Latin America to make sure that the United States and its ally Canada, of course, have control and access to both the incredibly abundant natural resources in Latin America and the Caribbean, and also a captive pool of cheap labor, so for its corporate interests. So what we're seeing in Venezuela is very much what the United States and its allies were doing in Africa. And looking at it in a global sense, it's not just the United States that is taking this strongly interventionist role in what was always its colonial or neo-colonial backyard, as it were. And if you look at what's happening in West Africa, France, and by extension the European Union, of course, are doing exactly the same thing in West Africa.
Right.
And if you look at the way the destabilization is currently going on in Cameroon, what has happened in Mali,
right.
What has happened in Ivory Coast and Burkina Faso, all the Central African Republic,
right.
all this disruption is the same thing there with the former colonial power France and its European Union allies as what we're seeing in Latin America with the United States and its allies targeting Venezuela. And so the reason to talk about all that more global stuff is because it explains in a global context very strongly what is happening in Venezuela, and of course to a lesser extent Nicaragua and what has been happening to Cuba for the last almost 60 years now.
You know, if you think about the claims, and there was some really amusing conversation, by the way, yesterday that went on at the State Department press briefing between, I forget the guy that's covering for them now, and Matt Lee from the Associated Press. But it was a big deal that the U.S. press and international press start using the correct terminology towards the person that we call random dude, Guaido, that he's not self-appointed president and he's not something else, but that he's the interim president, that he's the constitutional president, etc. But the whole idea that this is some sort of, democratic exercise, replacing an elected president from afar, when you tie it into the international scene, it takes you back to Cote d'Ivoire and the removal of that elected president at gunpoint by French troops, by the colonial troops.
Yeah, and then the murder of Gaddafi in Libya.
Yeah, which was invoked by some of the characters, including Marco Rubio a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, as an explicit threat towards Maduro.
Yeah, what's interesting is that you and I had this conversation, I think, a couple of weeks ago, and we more or less agreed that we didn't really think that, although a military intervention is always possible, it's much more likely that the United States would maintain its war of attrition against Venezuela, very much as it did against Nicaragua in the 1980s.
Right.
And when, after 10 years of exhausting war and economic sanctions, there was an election in Nicaragua, and people voted for the U.S. candidate because they were just exhausted.
Right.
And I think that is the U.S. game plan in Venezuela, and with the constant threat, of course, of hanging over people in Venezuela, which is part of the psychological warfare, part of the psychological abuse. This mass psychological abuse that the United States engages in consistently against its target regimes. And that's what happened in Nicaragua. In Nicaragua, people were constantly prepared. There were I remember being in Nicaragua at the time, and there were constant exercises by the people's militia preparing for a possible invasion.
This was, this is a psychological warfare, aside from actual warfare. This is, it's a terrorist campaign, in essence, with the biggest terrorist in the world.
Yeah, and you mentioned Ivory Coast, but we have to look back, too, to Angola and Mozambique what the United States and its racist apartheid allies in South Africa did to both those countries via the respective armed groups, RENAMO in Mozambique and UNITA and others in Angola. And that's we're likely to see that in Venezuela. We're likely to see armed incursions from Colombian territory. And it's clearer than ever now that the whole point of the peace negotiation under Juan Manuel Santos, the former Colombian president, was to eliminate
the FARC as
a possible player
that
might interfere with Colombian army and Colombian paramilitary incursions into Venezuela.
Let me ask you this, because you're invoking the situation in Nicaragua back in the 80s and 90s as a as an antecedent, perhaps, or certainly as a study. And so what ended up happening, the people were exhausted from this, terror campaign that lasted from the first day of the revolution, essentially, until the election of Violeta Chamorro. That's what you're referring to, right? And then what happened? What happened, in essence, was not so far afterwards, once the jackboots were pulled off the corners or whatever, went out and voted the Sandinistas back into power. And at the time, Honduras went from being the staging area for the Contra War to electing Mel Zelaya. So you have, these kinds of things that, history doesn't stop. Looking at South America specifically, as opposed to Central America 20, 30 years ago, Brazil is, you know, ready to go at the drop of a match. And the conditions in Brazil resemble those in Venezuela tremendously, even more pressure applied to them. Indigenous and African descended population that have been deprived of everything for centuries, who finally get to participate in the body of politic, get some actual share of the economy, and they strip that away. They, by doing what they did with Rousseff, and then by doing what they did with Lula. I mean, it was hilarious to hear people lecturing about the validity of the election of Maduro at the UN. The Brazilian representative who was there because Lula was in jail.
Right.
And I'm wondering if they start a fire in Venezuela, if it's going to it might consume Brazil.
Yeah, and there are the ridiculous thing about the coverage of Venezuela in mainstream media and in government statements from the European leaders and from North American leaders, and just look at what's happening to Justin Trudeau now, for example.
Yeah.
And his corruption is finally being uncovered. And these are the people that talk about, you know, corruption in Venezuela. Ridiculous. But if you look at the region, there are variations on what you've been saying across the region. And
yes.
So how has the United States managed to control the region without using military force exactly? Well, it's used its control of economic structures, and it's also used its ability to work with local elites who, with strong concentrations of media power, like you have in Argentina and with Clarín, the Clarín group, and in Chile with the Mercurio group, in Brazil with the El Globo group, and so they combine that media power with their right wing allies' control of judicial instances. And they also work very hard to divide the opposition. What are the material conditions that you were referring to in relation to Brazil or in the region generally? Well, if you look at Argentina now, and poverty is up around 50%.
Right.
And a large number of people are only eating one meal a day. I find that there was a report on television last night about the situation in Argentina. So Macri got into power, President Mauricio Macri got into power by lying to people that his neoliberal policies would bring prosperity to Argentina.
Right.
And of course, the reverse has happened.
Right.
And when going back to 1990 election, all the promises here in Nicaragua was of wonderful prosperity just around the corner, thanks to the right-wing government's adherence to the United States economic model. And the reverse happened. After 16 years of neoliberal politics, people were suffering power cuts of 12 hours a day here in Nicaragua.
Right.
Even the private business sector were craving a Sandinista win, because that would bring them some relief to their energy problems, because Venezuela at that time, as you pointed out earlier, was a very strong positive influence, galvanizing regional resources for the benefit of people at grassroots. And that was the fundamental contribution of Hugo Chavez working together with Fidel Castro from Cuba. That was his fundamental contribution. And that, of course, is why the corporate elites in the United States and Europe detested him.
Right.
Because he made available Latin America's resources for the benefit of the impoverished majority. Look at what's happening in Colombia. In Colombia, in Guajira, dozens of children are dying every week of hunger. That doesn't happen in Venezuela. But Colombia is the country that's accusing Venezuela of inflicting suffering on its people.
Yeah, delivering humanitarian aid across their bridge.
Yeah, and of course, what wasn't reported was that Venezuela sent some aid to Cúcuta,
Right.
Venezuela tried to send some aid to help the people that are dying of hunger in Colombia, and the Colombian government rejected it.
Of course not. Yeah,
which,
right.
So, but of course, that doesn't get reported. Yeah. And then, but and there's so much going on in the region that reflects the fact that the United States has a very weak hand, and despite all its military power, despite all its economic power. Even the Spanish foreign minister, I think it was yesterday, admitted in an interview that they are under the table dealing directly with the government of President Maduro.
Right.
Because he's the guy that is the legitimate president and actually has control and authority in Venezuela. So even the Spanish government, which is a kind of supine ally of the United States and does whatever the United
right.
States tells it.
Right.
Even they recognize the reality on the ground.
You know, go ahead.
Let's also look at the whole issue of corruption. Apart from what's happening in Canada with Justin Trudeau and the scandal that he's involved in covering up, or trying to cover up relatively unsuccessfully, and look at what's happening in Argentina and Ecuador. In Lenin Moreno now, Lenin Moreno got into power on a left-wing ticket, on the progressive ticket of the party of Rafael Correa, and then did exactly the opposite. He's actually implementing the economic and political agenda of Ecuador's right-wing opposition that lost the election. Moreno won. And now what's coming out? Now we're discovering that Lenin Moreno has been the beneficiary via an offshore company of a luxury apartment in Spain.
Isn't that amazing how that works?
And so all that's coming out now. And what he's now done a deal with the IMF for some paltry sum, something like a relatively paltry sum given the size of the Ecuadorian economy.
Right.
But on the basis of that agreement, he's now sacked something like 10,000 public workers in the space of 3 days. So what does that mean? What that means is that the neoliberal model peddled by United States proxies like Lenin Moreno and like Mauricio Macri and like Jair Bolsonaro and like Sebastian Piñera, it's coming apart at the seams. It just doesn't hold, because the reality for ordinary people is inescapable for ordinary people.
And that's the kernel. That's the kernel of the demise of it.
They can't live on the kind of rhetoric right. coming out of the right. Right, their right-wing political right. leaders'
right.
mouths.
Yeah, they need
and
food.
That is the United States' fundamental weakness.
It is.
Weakness in Venezuela.
It's the weakness across the board with that whole position. And, you know, we've been saying for years in our conversations, basically, you got China's model, win-win, and you've got the U.S. model, which is we're going to take all your stuff, basically, and,
right.
and which one is sustainable and which one is not. what you have, excuse me, a couple of things on display with respect to Venezuela, and one became a little more apparent to me. I did a crosstalk with RT last week as one of the guests. And it was about Venezuela, and one of the guests was Isaac Nahon Sarfati, who is an academic at some Canadian university. He is from Venezuela, and he reminded us a couple of times that his grandmother still lives in Caracas. And he conveyed, in essence, as an adherent, the rhetoric of the right. This is the stuff that's on, you know, the TV stations, all the private TV stations down there that they're trying to sell to the people. And that was, he blames Maduro and socialism for those 12 hours of there being no power in Caracas. You know, the whole economic crisis is a product of corruption and socialism inherent, contradictions. And so, you know, obviously their strategy is the same thing that was used in Nicaragua. People, after a while, don't really care what the cause is. They feel the pain all the time. What button do I push to make it stop? And so electing Violeta Chamorro, regardless of whatever the logic is to you or whatever, if that's going to make the pain stop, then that's what we'll do. And that's kind of what the effort is behind, you know, this all the starving of Venezuelans to create enough pain to create that kind of dissonance among the population, so that they'll, you know, acquiesce if not actively revolt. But now, hold on, because here's the point of that. It was kind of a long piece of context. The actual effort here has been, and the measure of Maduro's power has been, whether or not the military will stay loyal to the government. This is what they keep spewing here. They have like almost like a scoreboard with that. And what they don't mention is that the military was a part of a coup, what now it's 17 years ago, okay? And the people undid that coup. And the polling data right now says across the board, even including the people who support the opposition, they do not want foreign military or other intervention in determining their fate. 86%. So the strategy is a dead end.
No, and the United States strategy is not working, and it's not going to succeed. And that's, I may be wrong about that, but that's how I feel at the moment, given all the information available.
Yep.
Because what you just pointed out is a very strong fundamental reality. Even people who may not be Chavista are Bolivarian in the sense that
that's right.
They value the heritage of Simón Bolívar as Venezuelans, and they aren't going to let the Colombian right wing invade with impunity their country, their society, their economy. And they're certainly not going to let the gringos do it, the Yankees. They're not going to let the United States do it.
I mean, even the OAS headquarters in Washington is named after Bolívar.
So if you look at the U.S. strategy, and it's can we talk? Do we have a little bit of time to talk about Nicaragua in this context?
We've got 3 minutes.
Okay. So, and what's happened in Nicaragua? We just had elections in Nicaragua on the Caribbean coast, in which something like 420,000 people were entitled to vote. Usually the turnout in those Caribbean coast elections is around 40 to 45%. This time around it was something like 46%, which is good for given the history of those elections. The elections were for 90 seats in the Caribbean coast autonomous regional assembly, and because in Nicaragua around 33% of Nicaragua's national territory is owned under common title by the indigenous peoples of the country, and those indigenous peoples have their own autonomous regime in all along the Caribbean coast, and that's what the elections were about. Out of those 90 seats, 64 will go to candidates of the FSLN following those election results.
Yeah.
Right? Now, this is the country where it's supposed to be a dictator.
Right.
Okay. They just held elections. Right. There were nobody inside Nicaragua is claiming, and certainly none of the 19 political parties participated in those elections. None of those parties are claiming, making any claims of fraud. Okay?
Right.
So, All nonsense, all the corporate lies, all the insidious attempts to paint the Sandinista government as a bloodthirsty dictatorship last year. People are still saying, for example, that Daniel Ortega was responsible for 300 deaths by security forces.
Right.
It's a downright lie.
I know.
And most of the deaths were caused by the opposition. And the total number of deaths around 270, and you can argue about whether 40 protesters died or 60 protesters died, but the fundamental nitty-gritty is the opposition that was responsible for most of the violence. And these elections on the Caribbean coast just bear that out. Just the week before the elections, there was an opinion poll published by the very well-respected kind of centrist M&R polling company, and that showed that currently the government has around 54% of support for its policies, and the personal approval of Daniel Ortega is still around 60%, which is dramatically lower than it was before when he was up around 80%, but that's after all the events of last year and the endless psychological warfare to which the government here has been subject. So why is that relevant for Venezuela? Because it just shows that the underlying reality doesn't change. The United States and its media allies and its NGO network and the corrupt human rights institutions in the Organization of American States and the United Nations, which actually the office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights is in conflict with the special rapporteurs that are named by the Geneva-based United Nations Human Rights Council.
Yeah.
So all that propaganda, all that model of psychological warfare does not change the underlying reality.
That's absolutely right.
And that is why the United States is going to lose in Venezuela.
Right.
It's what we said last time. What kind of defeat will the United States suffer in Venezuela? We're slowly seeing the shape of what that defeat is going to look like.
I agree. And, you know, this is one of the things that apparently gets lost on these people here who are used to being able to sway public opinion with their monopoly control of the media. But when people used to live outdoors or in tin cans and they suddenly have an apartment and now someone wants to evict them from the apartment, they understand exactly what's happening no matter what their television tells them. And this is the case in Venezuela for 2.5 million families, 2.5 million, households, because that's how many apartments were built by the revolution in a country with a population of about 25 million. In other words, for about 1 in 10 of the people there was a new apartment built. We got to stop right here. We're done. And I appreciate your time, and we'll speak with you again next week.
Thanks a million, Don.
Thank you. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. The recent clashes on the Indian-Pakistani border, while sparking anxiety over a potential war between nuclear rivals, provided a curious lesson in political judo. The Pakistani leadership, confronted with strikes on its territory, not only managed to defuse tensions, but also turned it into a minor PR victory. Can it make it last? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Hina Rabbani Har, Pakistan's former foreign minister and currently a member of the National Assembly. Madam Har, it's good to talk to you again. Thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure to be here.
Now, the tensions between India and Pakistan obviously have a very long history, and there were times not so long ago when one was much more likely to count on India exercising restraint and Pakistan acting more belligerently. Now it seems the tables have turned. What explains this dramatic reversal in postures?
You know, it's interesting that you point that out, because we've been saying this for the last many years, that Pakistan has changed. Pakistan is changing for the better, getting out of extremism, which we had unfortunately found ourselves enveloped in because of, you know, the historical baggage of the Afghan war, and becoming a moderate progressive society. I think the fact democratic regimes, the last two democratic regimes had much to do with it. Whereas at the same time, we see India going deeper and deeper into this ultra-nationalist, extremist, almost a Hindutva state, non-secular. And all thanks to Mr. Modi, who has now penetrated his vision into the fabric of Indian society. I think this crisis, unfortunate as it was, exposed the changed Pakistan versus the changed India. And if I were the world, I would be very scared of what I see in India right now.
For both leaders, it was definitely an opportunity to exercise their leadership, and they chose very different strategies. One of them chose to flex muscles. The other one, I thought, relied more on his wits. Do you think that's more reflective of the personality of the two leaders, Mr. Modi and Mr. Khan, or is it indeed more long-term reflective of the country's national standing and national posture?
Look, personalities certainly have a role to play. I think over here, more than Mr. Khan's personality, it's Mr. Modi's personality, which has had a role to play in what India has become in the last 5 years. I've been screaming at the top of my lungs for the last 5 years that what India is playing, that literally it's playing with fire, and it will not be able to put this genie of extremism back in the bottle. Because once you allow people to become so extremist in their thought process, in their action, in their reaction, then that becomes you. So India is no more the secular, shining, rising India that we thought was possible under Prime Minister Vajpayee or Prime Minister Manmohan Singh. It's a very different India. In Pakistan, I think the process of the reintroduction of democracy and the political parties maturing has had a huge role to play in it. And I think how you saw the parliament acted and reacted to this crisis, it was restrained, it was considered, it was debated. Prime Minister Khan found it very easy to take this posturing, which was what the parliament and the people of Pakistan wanted. So it's actually a reflection of changing societal behavior and changing national priorities for both countries. It's just visible to people like yourself now, perhaps from this incident.
Well, Madam Har, what is also visible to people like myself is that India is a democracy, and it is facing a major parliamentary election in May, which may explain why Prime Minister Modi may be more motivated to burnish his strongman image. I've also heard people say that this could be something more long-term. This could be a change in India's military strategy, it becoming more assertive. What do you think is more likely? Do you think it's mostly political, or do you think it's indeed strategic?
Look, I think it's a bit of both, okay? Because we saw 2 days back in a Rajasthan rally, election rally, Prime Minister Modi using the images of people who passed away in the Pulwama incident, right? So it is bringing nationalism and the military right in the middle of politics, okay? That's one. Secondly, again, people like myself have been observing this since perhaps Manmohan Singh's time, where the deep establishment in India is becoming more and more powerful. I remember the time when we wanted to solve the Siachen dispute, and Prime Minister Manmohan Singh was very keen to do so also, but was held back by what I can call the deep establishment in India. So in some ways, you know, I even tweeted about it. You see India and Pakistan following two very different trajectories. We are moving away from extremism into a moderate, progressive, hopefully a developing society. And India is moving towards a very, very belligerent, aggressive, extremist India. And I would just a little bit perhaps disagree with you when you say this is only election related, because the lynching of people, the whole process of using rape and pellet guns as state policy in Kashmir, and really very aggressive behavior towards Muslims, whether they were in Mumbai or Kashmir or Delhi or anywhere else, this started as soon as Prime Minister Modi came into power.
Well, Madam Har, the Pakistani government is also accused of major human rights abuses on its own territory, so let's not paint it black and white. But I'm more interested in the political angle of this whole skirmish, because when the security and the sovereignty of a state are directly engaged, there is always pressure on leaders to respond in a muscular and symmetric way in order not to look weak. And yet Prime Minister Khan went out of his way to stay conciliatory. Do you think his response would have been the same if he, like his Indian counterpart, were facing an important election?
No, this is what we really need to understand about Pakistan. Pakistan has changed on that count. Pakistan no more considers animosity against India, encouraging animosity amongst its nationals against any one of its neighbors as good state policy, right? This is where Pakistan is very different than India right now, okay? Because I think we've learned our lessons from history, and therefore we don't wish this upon India also. Because if they go on this trajectory, unfortunately, they will not be able to be responsible players in this region. This region has suffered for far too long because of this ongoing conflict between these two giants in the region. You know, if you look at any progress that this region could potentially have made, we've lost out, okay? I think we need to fight wars against poverty, against giving education to our people, giving health opportunities, giving economic opportunities. It's really sad if a neighbor as large as India moves towards this extremist, belligerent, aggressive nation, because it doesn't do any good to any of its neighbors, and least of all Pakistan.
Well, I agree with you that the Indian response was quite extraordinary because there were suicide attacks before, but it was the first time that Indian fighter jets crossed deep into Pakistan since, I think, the 1971 Indo-Pakistan War. How much of a shock do you think those Indian air raids were to the Pakistani political leadership?
You know, interestingly, I think with Prime Minister Modi being in power for the last 5 years in India, we in Pakistan were prepared for anything which is unreasonable, which could be a vote grabber. And close to the election coming in March, and we were quite mindful of the fact that any incident will be perhaps manufactured or created. I'm not pointing any fingers over there, but will be used as an excuse to do something very irresponsible. Because the extent of the irresponsibility of this act, and then the extent of the narrative shaping and the lies which have now been exposed internationally, it has actually damaged India's credibility far more than the length and breadth of this elections. So very responsible people in India are perhaps now waking up to that realization. And, you know, very responsible voices from India are also pointing out that we need to stop looking towards Pakistan for our indigenous problems. Because what has happened in Kashmir, the reaction of the Kashmiri people, is because of the very strong state terrorism or aggression which has been pointed towards them in the last 5 years. Now, I don't want to go into a blame game, right? I don't want to say you do this, we do that. I want to say that these two countries are far too important for the region, for their own people, and for the world. We need to really come to the negotiating table and really have an uninterrupted and uninterruptible dialogue, because dialogue is the only way to really take care of conflict long term. This conflagration of two nuclear states, whose purpose is it serving? It serves no one. It just creates a lot of negativity within the region and keeps the region and these two countries from going forward.
Well, again, one version that I heard in the Pakistani and the international media, whose interest it's serving, it's at least initially were intended to serve the interest of the ruling party in India. It's too early to say conclusively at this point of time, but do you think this incident will end up helping Mr. Modi's electoral chances, or do you think it will end up hurting him?
Look, I saw a Reuters report recently, which clearly says that his numbers are getting better right after this, right? And you see him in the electioneering process really using this as a powerful tool. I would be very, we never know how elections turn out, and we never know how politics play out, because now in the last 2-3 days, you see some sanity emerging. By now, their claims about killing 300 people in Pakistan when they did those air raids have been completely debunked by international media and international organizations. So it's really going to be anyone's game. But obviously, Prime Minister Modi is trying very hard and is quite sure that this will assist him. I can also see how it will assist him, because in the last 5 years, he's made a very ultra-nationalist, an ultra-extremist sort of narrative shaping in India has now almost become very ingrained. It's dangerous for India. As is it dangerous for Pakistan.
Now, you mentioned before the role of the media and how differently the two countries engage the media, because India almost immediately closed off the side of the suicide bombing attack, whereas Pakistan, on the contrary, invited media over to the side of the strikes to undermine the Indian damage claims. I wonder if this is perhaps a new area of foreign policy or diplomacy for Pakistan, engaging the international public opinion much more proactively and by the use of not only traditional but also social media?
You know, I don't think it's about public opinion over here, and I don't think it's about how Pakistan was able to, do a great job at PR handling. I don't think this is a PR handling exercise. I think this is a changing reality exercise, and I think Pakistan was just able to engage both the world to its changing reality. And I think the importance of a state in the world depends on its credibility, right? Now, the credibility of India through this whole crisis and how they managed it has actually been reduced to a very, very low number, simply for the fact that every claim that was made by the establishment, by the military, by the Indian politicians, by the Indian media, has actually been proven to be incorrect. Satellite imagery has proven it to be incorrect. Now, everything that Pakistan was saying could be proven by exposing them to realities on the ground. And therefore, Pakistan was much more keen to engage with the national media and the international media because what it was saying could be corroborated by facts on the ground. Now, this is a very dangerous situation because if a country feels, if the people who are in power in that particular country, in India, for instance, feel that they can fool their own people into this ultra-nationalistic, you know, jingoistic reaction by feeding them lies, and then the media picks up those lies and multiplies them many times, then what are you turning your population into? And how are you expecting them to react to a neighbor like Pakistan? Because then everything that happens in India is immediately put on Pakistan's shoulder. This is a dangerous, dangerous trend. And for a country as large as India, aspiring to be a Security Council member, to lose its credibility this much and to be using lies and manufactured events, both in front of international, forget the media, international players and its own people. I think it's very, very sad. And I don't think this plays on well for anyone. Even Pakistan should not be happy by an India which is choosing to act such in such a manner. We don't want to embarrass them.
Well, Madam Har, we have to take a short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Hina Rabbani Har, Pakistan's former foreign minister and a member of the National Assembly. Madam Har, while the current episode seems to be diffused, the initial premise for the attacks remains. That is, militant groups which India considers terrorists, which the United Nations considers terrorists, operating in Pakistani territory. Do you think that could lead to the tensions flaring up again in the future?
Look, I hope the initial premise as it existed 10 years back has moved a long, long way. And it, you might have the luxury to be able to ignore that. I unfortunately do not have the luxury to ignore it simply for the reason that Pakistan in the last 10 years has lost 70,000 of its citizens to trying to find these very militant groups that the world claims we have done nothing about. Pakistan has lost 7,000 to 8,000 soldiers, paramilitary forces, fighting these very militant groups, these terrorist groups. Now, Pakistan, like any other state, cannot do everything at the same time, right? Now, the premise of this particular attack being manufactured or planned or emanating from Pakistani soil is entirely incorrect. And it has almost been proven to be incorrect. Now, to use anything that happens indigenously because of state policy, because of state terrorism in Kashmir, as a tool to whip Pakistan is obviously not fashionable or allowed or will hold. Because eventually all of us have to look internally. Pakistan is a country today, by the way, which is a changed country. We are all confident enough to look internally at the fault lines that we had that we're trying to correct. We are trying to protect minorities better. We're trying to protect the IDPs, the people who were displaced because of military's action against militant groups in the Fatah region, which is now Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, and everywhere else. And the fabric of our society has suffered because of that. So this, to be told for a country which has suffered so much, and frankly speaking, not suffered for your sake or for the Americans' sake or anyone else's sake, but for our own sake. We had to correct many of the mistakes that we made in the past. In the last 10 years, we have started the journey of correcting them rather quickly. Now, I think in some ways, this incident perhaps gives the world an opportunity to be able to look slightly more deeply into what Pakistan is today and not to judge Pakistan by what it was during many, many past regimes which were not democratic.
Madam Har, speaking about this changed Pakistan, the Indian Prime Minister, when he was responding to this gesture of goodwill on the part of your country, the release of the pilot, said in a pretty straightforward and I would even say threatening way that this whole skirmish on the border was just a training practice and that, quote, the real thing is yet to come. Is there any point beyond which Pakistan will not be able to maintain its conciliatory posture?
Look, Pakistan, as a policy, not by accident, did two things, okay? Pakistan did not remain conciliatory to the extent of allowing India to enter its international borders its territory and exit without there being a retaliation. We retaliated because we had the responsibility to protect our
Absolutely,
sovereign borders.
Absolutely, but you also sought to de-escalate. Would there be a point when you will be much less motivated to do that?
This is exactly what I'm telling you. So we let them know that if you can do military adventurism, we can also do it on this side, right? Now, I am very, very concerned about a prime minister who can, first of all, use that type of language, about talking about, military adventurism in a way that this was a pilot project, you will see what will happen, we will get into your houses. Who allows him to get into anyone else's international borders? The Security Council doesn't, the UN Charter doesn't, international law doesn't. So what my reaction to your specific question is that if they resort to military adventurism, I think all of Pakistan stands united behind its armed forces. And I think our armed forces, if anything, have displayed that they don't need to make stories about what they've achieved, but be able to actually achieve. Did we do any chest thumping on putting two fighter pilots, fighter planes down, or capturing the pilot? We actually turned the pilot into a hero and forgot to celebrate our own pilot who had actually downed that plane, simply for the reason because we did not want to create this war hysteria. You know, we sent a pilot within 48 hours back into Indian territory. So this is the difference in approaches that the two countries have right now.
I agree with you on the difference in the approaches, but I think the kind of world that we live in is not always in compliance with the international law or even ethical norms. I mean, there are a number of countries in the world that allow themselves the right to strike targets in somebody else's territory. Israel would be one, the United States would be another. If India proceeds with this kind of approach, and India is a much, much stronger state than yours, I'm asking you not as a, social commentator, but as somebody who used to be in charge of these very, very important decisions, how much will be too much for Pakistan? Because there's always a limit to everything in my country, from its recent experience, you can see that sometimes when you're being pushed too strongly, you will retaliate and respond. And sometimes that response will be not to somebody else's liking.
Okay, first of all, so far, I don't think your claim of India being militarily much stronger holds. Of course, it is a much bigger country and it spends far more than Pakistan does on its military, much as international opinion may be completely in a different sort of direction. Okay, so simple. The simple answer to your not so simple question is that Pakistan will not take any military adventurism into its sovereign territory. If that happens, Pakistan has not only the right, but the responsibility. Please understand this. We have the responsibility to react. All of Pakistan stands as one. The parliament has made exactly the same, given the same direction in its resolution. The National Security Council says exactly the same thing in its meeting. So the executive, the parliament, and the people of the Pakistan stand behind the armed forces, because the armed forces of Pakistan have now acted very, very responsibly. And this is a united nation against Indian belligerents. I can assure you, this episode has put Pakistan, I think, strongly bound Pakistan together. And I think it's proven to many Pakistanis that when Pakistan stands together as a united front, Pakistan is a far stronger nation than its much bigger nation.
Now, we are talking about one of the most militarized regions in the world with a very, very high security presence. And I think it's a valid question. How would a young local man, and we are talking about a man in his 20s who is believed to be this initial suicide bomb attack, how would he be able to source 750 pounds of explosives to carry it out? Wouldn't that be in the interest of Pakistan to find out? And don't you think that your country should be perhaps a little bit more forthcoming in offering its assistance to India to deal with this major terrorist issue in the Indian-controlled Kashmir?
Look, I think we have been more than forthcoming, to the extent that the Indian media and the Indian politicians have used it as Pakistan coming to its knees, wanting to negotiate, asking us, oh, we will help, but they will actually not help. So this is all narrative shaping, right? I think Pakistan has said at every forum, from every level, that please, we would like to assist you in this, give us some credible evidence, we would like to move with you, we want to fight, not only fight terrorism, we want to discuss terrorism with you, because we all have different versions of who is a state terrorist and who isn't, right? So look, on this particular incident, this particular incident, the intelligence that one has heard so far, and I'm not in government, I don't have access to any intelligence per se, but from what I have heard from credible sources, is that the mood in Kashmir, because of what you can only call state terrorism, and really high-handed behavior, where a major, listen, I mean, you will say I'm going too much into details, if a major of the military of India puts a Kashmiri in front of his jeep and takes him out and allows him to be stoned and he becomes a decorated man, this is telling you what India has done in that country, in that region. If there's anyone within the territory of Pakistan who has assisted, who has helped, we are not supportive of anyone who assists violence anywhere, be it inside our borders or outside. That's a changed Pakistan that the world is perhaps taking too long to accept, because you are judging us by our previous reputation and not being able to understand that in the last 10, 15 years, Pakistan has changed direction and Pakistan is credibly, strongly, vehemently following, trying to completely eliminate extremism from all parts of our society.
Now, let me ask you one more question about an important player in the region, which is the United States. I've heard some experts claim that this Indian-Pakistani issue didn't dissolve on its own, that the Trump administration engaged in some, quote, quiet diplomacy behind the scenes, which with this White House is hard to believe, both when it comes to the word quiet and when it comes to the word diplomacy. What are you hearing in Islamabad? Is that true?
Okay, so again, I need to remind you, I'm not in government, so I do not know exactly what and where. But from what I know and from what I see, starting from President Trump calling attractive news coming in from the subcontinent after this conflict, after this crisis erupted, which is obviously an indication that the Americans were playing a role. And then he went on to also say that we are trying to speak to both parties and we are hearing attractive news. So he was obviously talking about American role in trying to defuse the situation. Beyond that, also, we also hear that Secretary Pompeo also played a role. So look, when two nuclear states stand eyeball to eyeball, then, of course, the world would choose to try and de-escalate the situation. I thought the world could have chosen to do it earlier. We should not have even reached this point. But it's important that we understand that we have been very restrained, we have been constrained, we have been very, very careful and all of that. But with a country as large and as militarily sort of robust or well endowed, let's just say, because I don't know about the skill set, hasn't shown much, but well endowed as India, to be as aggressive and as belligerent in its mindset, coming all the way up from the Prime Minister to the smallest media house in India and emanating to the rest of the population, is a very dangerous trend.
Madam Hari, as you've been trying to say throughout this interview, countries change. Pakistan has changed significantly. So can India, not only for the worse, but also for the better. So let's hope that the May elections perhaps will make it a little bit less belligerent. But we have to leave it there. It's always a pleasure talking to you. Thank you very much for being so generous with your time.
Pleasure to be here.
I encourage our viewers to keep this conversation going on our social media pages and hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.